commonly refer to Genesis story and the rest of the Bible. It's much more common than Adam and Eve. It's a flood story. Jesus makes reference to Sodom and Gomorrah, but 25 times or so in the rest of the Bible, about half of those times in the Old Testament, about half in the New. And so we hear these names, Sodom and Gomorrah, drummed into our consciousness as we move through the biblical readings of the year. We have English words like sodomy, which regularly remind us of this story. And so how we deal with it is of crucial importance at several levels. I suppose in recent years, the most pressing question that people have asked of this story is, what is the sin of Sodom? And a struggle over what that sin is and how that might affect our way of thinking about issues of sexuality today. I don't want to neglect that and bring it up and open up that question, but I'm interested in the neglected dimensions of the Sodom and Gomorrah story. I will claim that the Sodom and Gomorrah story has fundamentally to do with natural disaster. It's an experience of natural disaster. I will also be interested in issues of corporate evil. That's to say, when you think of Sodom and Gomorrah, you might think of Nazi Germany. And the issue of, are there a sufficient number of righteous in this community in order to affect the future positively or negatively? I'm interested in the question of judgment. How do we deal with God's judgment? I want to claim, for example, that the translation punish or punishment in the Old Testament is simply mistaken. And I think as translations come along in the years, I think that word will disappear from English translations. And there is no Hebrew word for punish. No Hebrew word for punishment. And we need to review that particular theme, not least because of the effect that it has on our understanding of God and God's ways of the world. Another theme in this text that I'm intrigued with is the theme of intercessory prayer. Abraham appeals to God on behalf of the city, even though he's not a member of that community. His nephew Lot is a member of that community. And it's interesting that in all of Abraham's intercessions, he never mentions Lot as a factor in his concern for the future of that city. So try to open up the questions that these texts raise and think as carefully as we can about them. And so let's just take a look at this text. And if you will, the basic story begins in 1816. And but I'd like to go back to chapter 13 in Genesis. This is where Sodom and Gomorrah are introduced to the reader. And in chapter 13 is the struggle between Abraham and Lot over which part of the promised land the one or the other is going to receive. And Abraham gives Lot the choice, and Lot picks the Jordan Valley down near present-day Dead Sea, and these comments are made in chapter 13 about that situation or about that setting, 13:10. And Lot looked about him and saw that the plain of the Jordan was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord. Perhaps a reference to the Garden of Eden, we don't know for sure, at least like it. Like the land of Egypt, in the direction of Zoar, which is a city that will be of those Sodom and Gomorrah, that And this was before the Lord had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay, there you are, your first introduction to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so Lot chose that city, that area. And then verse 13, now the people of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. So here the reader is introduced to the Sodom and Gomorrah situation, and it's a negative appraisal of the situation in Sodom and Gomorrah. And one might expect, given those references to Sodom and Gomorrah, that we'd immediately enter into the story that we get with chapter 18. But chapter 14 moves into related concerns. And then we go to, but in chapter 14, it should lift up a text in chapter 14. Verse 10 of chapter 14, and the language, it's a little geological description of the area around Sodom and Gomorrah. The valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So we get a little bit of an image of the kind of the geological character of this part of the world. And that's important as we think about this. If you were to draw you immediately recognize that as the Mediterranean Sea. and so you get Israel here, and if you were to go up into Azerbaijan, Georgia, that part, east, the far eastern Turkey, you would, in this area, there is a geological rift that begins and runs down through down the Jordan Valley. The Dead Sea is the lowest point in the geological rift. It's over 1,300 feet below sea level, and goes down into East Africa. And so this particular character of this area is important in thinking about the story. The salt content of the Dead Sea is about 35%. It's twice that of the Great Salt Lake. It's extensive sulfur, brimstone. It's easily ignited substances, bitumen deposits, petrochemical springs. In the area, and so it's geologically volatile, if you will, and it's likely that an earthquake with associated fires devastated the region at one point, and that's reflected in this story that we have. So we have, again, this in some fundamental sense, we have to do in this text with a natural disaster. That sort of explosion may explain the fate of Lot's wife. She's engulfed with chemical fallout, and a pillar of salt is not too far-fetched. It's what might happen to an individual if they didn't get out of the way quick enough. One of the ways of thinking about this is a story. Then, is in terms of natural disaster, and the text wants to claim that there's a link between human behaviors and a negative effect upon the environment, between moral order and cosmic order. We know very well today that connection. We know it needs to be convinced of the link between moral order and cosmic order today. All we need to do is just look south over the last couple of months to the Gulf of Mexico to see how human behaviors can negatively affect the larger environment of which we are a part. The stories are many and long, pollution. And one of the sad dimensions of the church's use of biblical material is that the church has failed to discern this environmental concern in biblical text. And because of that failure to discern the interest of the text in that kind of issue, the church has not been at the forefront of issues of environmentalism as much as it might have been. And so we're beginning to catch up on this, to see just the remarkable number of biblical texts that are concerned about the environment. And it goes, we could begin back in Genesis 2, where you get the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. Well, to till, that's okay. It's an okay translation. But it's the everyday Hebrew word for serve. What does it mean to serve the land? To keep the land. I mean, there's an initial claim at the beginning. But and let me just read one other text as an example of numerous instances of biblical concern about the environment. In the book of Hosea, first of the minor prophets, there's a remarkable text at the beginning of chapter 4. Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There's no faithfulness or loyalty. There's no knowledge of God in the land. Swearing, lying, murder, stealing, adultery break out. Bloodshed follows bloodshed. And now, no. Therefore, given that list of sins on the part of human beings, therefore, the land mourns. And all who live in it languish, together with the wild animals and the birds of the air, and even the fish of the sea are perishing. Remarkable connection between human sin, human behavior, and the negative effect upon the environment. I would claim that the Sodom and Gomorrah story, I'm not unique here, the Sodom and Gomorrah story is a part of this larger concern for the connection of human behaviors and its effect, negative or positive effect upon the environment. So, continue to work. Those of you who are interested in this question, continue to work with the biblical basis here for our environmental considerations, our environmental efforts, the urgency of our this dimension of our life together. If I can make a self-reference here. Just 2 days ago, I got an email from Baker Academic saying that my new book has not just been released. I haven't seen it yet, but the title of the book is Creation Untamed, The Bible, God, and Natural Disasters. And it's an effort to deal with biblical materials, primarily Old Testament materials, dealing with the issue of natural disaster, a much neglected dimension of biblical material. We've got natural disasters from the flood to Sodom and Gomorrah to the plagues in Egypt. I mean, there's a string of texts here which have tended to be neglected in Old Testament scholarship. And we have to be careful here, too, in terms of how we think about human sin and ecological devastation of one kind or another. Several levels, you might suggest that in reading about the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, isn't God really responsible in a significant way for the degradation of the environment? You read some of these texts and the question about God's involvement becomes important. And then there's a very important issue here. Make sure that all natural disasters are not somehow laid at the feet of human behavior. And so one has to begin with the stories of Genesis and the stories of creation and understand that negative environmental effects, if you will, natural disasters, are not simply due to human behaviors. This is the way in which God created the world. Natural disasters are an integral part of the world that God created. God created the world good, but not perfect. And so we need to think about the nature of the creation of which we're a part, and to understand that God's good creation has considerable capacity to visit us with storms and earthquakes, etc., etc., quite apart from, certainly before, quite apart from human sin. Let's come back to the text and take a little closer look at some details here and look at and again, questions at any time. Beginning with 1816, and I'll just give you the literary frame of this story. In 1816, the men, you have the appearance of the three men to Abraham at the beginning of chapter 18. As we move through the story, we get one of them is God. At 16, the men, the three men that appeared to Abraham, set out from there, and they looked toward Sodom. That's the first element. Abraham went with them. Then in verse 22, and the men turned from there and went toward Sodom. So they looked toward Sodom, and they went toward Sodom. And then at the beginning of chapter 19, the two angels, oh, where did we get angels here? I thought they were men. Well, both. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening. Okay, now we're down to two. They looked toward Sodom, they went toward Sodom, and they came to Sodom. That's the basic flow of this text. And then just to look at some of those opening verses, get a sense for this. Verse 17, the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do?" Isn't that interesting? I don't want to keep my people ignorant about what God is about in the life of the world. Seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. No, that's interesting for God to say, "No, I don't want to do that for heaven's sake. For I have chosen him, and he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring about for Abraham what he has promised." Just a couple of words there before reading on. God does not want to keep the people of God ignorant. Jesus sends the Spirit to lead us into all the truth. It's a common temptation in the life of the church that we have the basic truths about God already, folks. And we need to be protective of what we have now, package it up, right. This house will become a desolation. And so if you get this divine if, so let's do justice, or we might say, take care of the environment, okay? If you do, then God says, this is going to be your future. If you don't, if not, then this is going to be your future. So the divine if, I mean, you might say, well, God actually knows what the future will be. Well, hold back on that just a little bit. If God actually knows, then God to lay out these two possibilities is a deceptive act. And so we've got to work with God's the understanding here of God entering into the human situation and catching up human beings and having them participate in the shaping of the future. And what people do then will affect the shape of that future. So when you think, coming back to this statement in Genesis 18, if not, I will know there that divine if is a genuine if. And so the participation with Abraham in this conversation is going to shape the future of the city. So it's interesting that what human beings, what Abraham in this case, thinks about the situation. options, but what people do, what people pray for, will be important in the moving into the future and the actual shaping of that future. But Abraham or anyone else prays for, gets engaged in, they bring new energy to the situation, decisiveness with respect to the situation, insight into the decision under consideration. And so given the participation of human here, in this case Abraham, that gives God new ingredients. Okay? Abraham, with energy now, introduces some new stuff, okay, and gives God some new ingredients to work with in moving into the future. And so the participation of the human being creates a new decision-making situation for God. God's got new ingredients with which to work on the basis of the human participation. Your prayers count? Your prayers, help shape the future. And God will pick up that those prayers and move into the future with them. God has new ingredients with which to work. God has more possibilities with which to work. And so you know, in 1822 following, then the men turned from there and went toward Sodom, while Abraham remained standing before the Lord. And then there is this exchange, this famous exchange, between Abraham and God. Abraham, verse 23, came near and said, "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked?" Again, as I suggested earlier, it's helpful here to think of a modern parallel like Nazi Germany. Okay, you're going to visit the Allied armies, are God's agents of judgment. And are you going to sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Yeah, afraid to take care of the situation. The righteous and the wicked are going to oftentimes fall together. Suppose, Abraham says, suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not forgive it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked so that the righteous spares the wicked. Far be that from you! And here then comes this direct question of Abraham to God. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what's just? Wow. What kind of conversations do you have with God? Do you bring questions like that to God? And all you need to do is, if you were to read the book of Psalms through that lens of asking questions of God, I mean, they're all over the place. And it encourages a genuine engagement. Well, what do you really think about this? And that kind of engagement with God is, deep, sharp questions of God are encouraged by, I mean, Abraham, Moses, we saw some last night, Jeremiah is filled with this material. And conversation then becomes important here, where Abraham now intercedes on behalf of the city, probably because Lot's there and some members of his family are there, but he never mentions them in his intercession. He doesn't pray just for the righteous in the city, he prays for the whole city. Right. And that the righteous and the wicked alike will be saved from this cataclysm. So we might move to chapter 19 and get maybe the sins of Sodom for a moment here. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of Sodom when Lot saw them, and he rose to meet them, bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, "Please, my lords, turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night, wash your feet, then you can rise early and go on your way." And they said, "No, we'll spend the night in the square." But he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. And here's the verse that is so often cited these days, verse 4. "But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom," notice every "the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man." Okay, notice the catching up. Every, okay, male in the city. Okay. "Surrounded the house, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. And almost certainly that has reference to sexual activity. And verse 6, then Lot went out from the door to the men and shut the door after him and said, I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Look, I have two daughters. I mean, you think, what kind of father is this? I mean, really, what kind of father is this? I have two daughters who have not known a man. They are betrothed, though. We find out later that they are in betrothed, and in that culture, betrothal is as good as marriage. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. Now, there is a long and unfortunate discussion of Lot's behaviors here. A massive effort, in my estimation, it's changing now in recent times, but a massive effort to excuse Lot. And that hospitality in that culture means you give over to the visitor the best that you have, or whatever the case may be. I think that's just, you're not responsible. And one of a couple of reasons why that's not a responsible behavior on Lot's part. Indeed, I would want to claim that Lot's use of his daughters here is a part of the sin of Sodom. And it's a way of catching up a vivid description of what is wrong with this city, with people in it. And one of the reasons why we're, I think, finally forced to recognize, and that the text finally forces us to recognize, that Lot's behaviors as a father here are irresponsible, is at the end of the story, you have this long piece from verses 30 to 38 in about Lot and his two daughters, thinking that they're the only ones left in the world, and the two daughters scheme with one another to get their father drunk. And they say, verse 31, there's not a man on earth coming to us after the manner of all the world. Let us make our father drink wine, and we'll lie with him so that we may preserve offspring through our father. And it goes down with each of the daughters in turn. And the striking thing here is Lot is placed in the same passive situation as he had placed the daughters. And so it's what goes around, comes around here, image of what happens. Now, come back to the sins of Sodom, which I think includes Lot's behaviors. Every man in town surrounds the house, old and young. If that had been, if they had gotten their way, the effect would have been gang rape. And I think the best context or parallel context of which one might think here would be, say, the common behavior of prisoners toward new entrants into the prison system. What is one of the ways in which they will show their dominance and their control of the situation is through rape. It's not an uncommon political reality in time of war. Think Bosnia. And to demonstrate who's in charge here. And that is the primary motivation, I think, on the part of, if you got all the men in town, it would be various sexual orientations that would probably be involved here, but certainly there would be heterosexuals in this group. Now, if you, in examining the sins of Sodom, if you go to all those 25 plus references to Sodom and Gomorrah and the rest of the Bible, only one text out of all 25 makes specific reference to sexual sins. But they make reference often to other sins. And one of the more striking texts with regard to the sins of Sodom is in Ezekiel. Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel 16, beginning with verse 48. And I think oftentimes, I suspect, that we zero in on the sexual sins here so that we can escape from being accused of, we're not like that. And then we can escape from the sharp word against Sodom. Verse 48 of Ezekiel 16, as I live, says the Lord God, your sister Sodom and her daughters have not done to you and your daughters as you and your daughters have done. This was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excessive food, and prosperous ease. Kind of close to home here. And they did not aid the poor and the needy. Connects up with the outcry language that you've got in Genesis 18. They were haughty, did abominable things before me. Some see sexual reference there, but it's not specific. Therefore, I removed them when I saw it. Notice that list of sins of Sodom. Let's not probe the sins of Sodom in such a way that we can somehow escape here. Or when Jesus makes reference to the sins of Sodom in Matthew 10, he's sending out the disciples to be into the mission which he's called them. I'm sending you out like sheep into the wall against the wolves and so forth. And then verse 14. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet as you leave that house or town, truly I tell you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment for that town. Now, clearly for Jesus in that case, the sin of Sodom is inhospitality. Now, that's the reference that Jesus makes to the text. The one text that does have a sexual reference is in the little book of Jude, which most of us don't find the occasion to read often. It's difficult. Starting with Jude, it's only one chapter. 1:6, and the angels who did not keep their own position but left their proper dwelling, he has kept an eternal change in the deepest darkness for the judgment of the great day. Likewise, verse 7, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which in the same manner as they indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural lust, serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. And that particular translation, if you've got a good Bible, you'll have various translations here. The NRSV has a footnote with regard to unnatural lust, namely, went after other flesh. And what does that mean? Well, a common, not always, but a common understanding is that's a reference to the angels in the text. Because that's the identification of the visitors to town, which the men wanted to know. And so the question is then, does one have to do here not with human-to-human sexual encounter or activity, but human angel? Verse 6 refers to angel as well. And so that it's a sexual reference, but maybe a little bit different than the one we commonly understand this text refers to. So, let's see. How do we want to open it up here? Maybe say a couple things about the importance of the number of people in the city. Why didn't we start out with one? Why do you start out with 50 and then leave off at 10? It's interesting. So the number of righteous people in any given situation is important. Don't get precise in terms of, well, think literally of 10. But in any, again, think Nazi Germany, or maybe America for that matter, their evil ways, that the entire community is deeply infected and by this sin and evil. And the presence of the righteous in the city, or in the country, or any community for that matter, the numbers of righteous that are present here, and I use the language of critical mass, number of righteous is important, whether or not they can have the kind of redemptive or positive effect in the life of the community so that the sin and evil of others can be countered. So if you have too few righteous, so the sin and evil takes control of the situation, then that's the conversation, I think, that God and Abraham have. And finally boils down to 10, and Abraham leaves off the conversation at 10 and doesn't pursue it further, recognizing that there's an insufficient number of righteous in that city to have a positive effect for the future of the city. It's got to go on. Again, think not the German. Maybe I can read a couple of sentences from this of mine. It's a truism to say that the wickedness of a few can adversely affect the larger group of which they're a part. And here, in the Sodom and Gomorrah story, the point is reversed. The righteousness of a few can so permeate a wicked society that they can save it from the destructive effects of its own evil ways. At the same time, a buildup of wickedness can become so deep and so broad that too few righteous may be present to have any appreciable positive effect on the situation, to keep it from snowballing out of control. For Sodom, this is fewer than 10 persons. The critical mass effect of the righteous in Sodom is so diminished as to be unable positively to shape its own future. And one of the questions that might be raised is, talking about the future of any city, country, again, don't think 10 in any narrow sense, but a sufficient number of righteous to have an impact on the future of the city. Well, enough. Let's talk about this a little bit. Maybe some of your questions, comments. Yes, please.
This brings to mind immediately the influence of the Tea Party movement. And I guess I'm disturbed at how you know what's righteous when a group believes they're totally right or have the answers and come together and have a political course. We could still be in trouble.
Now, there are certainly significant differences among us as to how one defines, identifies what righteousness means. And we will continue to be, I think, at odds with one another in assessing what the lack of such righteousness as we perceive it, the presence of such righteousness, may mean for the future of the city, of the kind of community of which we are a part. It's interesting that with regard to when Abraham confronts God and with the righteous and the wicked in the city, there isn't sort of an immediate definition given for what righteous means in that context. And scholars have struggled with a definition of the word there. It seems clear that the children can be eliminated from consideration. I think we wouldn't want to, if you think in modern terms of, say, a Nazi Germany and the judgment visited upon Nazi Germany, but I would say divine agents of the Allied armies, just think of the number of children that were wiped out in that judgment, if you will. And so some people go to children here and think that they're particularly, it's more in some sort of the translation innocent is also there. It's doubtful, though, that in the Old Testament, contemporary situation, we're going to disagree on this. And so we have to continue that conversation, try to sort it out. And good luck. Other comments, questions you have? Yes, please.
How might this relate to the whole sacrificial theme? The blemished lamb needs to be sacrificed. Isaac's son, or Abraham's son, needs to be sacrificed. It sounds totally nonsensical to us. And the two daughters need to be sacrificed. And Jesus needs to be sacrificed. How do they connect?
Well, tomorrow's topic is the near sacrifice of Isaac. where we try to struggle a little bit with that, and what that might entail, and the remarkable differences among scholars and others as to how to assess the sacrificial motif that occurs here. But I would not want to place in the same ballpark the command to sacrifice Isaac and Lot's behaviors toward his daughter.
Why?
I think the fact that God makes the command might suggest some difference between God and Lot here, with which you might work with. And I think the larger context, as I suggested, wants to specifically condemn Lot's behavior. And now it may be that, as we'll see tomorrow, it may be that outside readers want to condemn God's command of Abraham and Abraham's response in that context too. But there are significant differences there. I just think we ought not to be collapsed. Yeah. Yes, please.
In your opinion, how much effort should we put into trying to take these very ancient texts into a modern day context versus just acknowledging that this was a very different time and place? Their social mores were so very different from what we would recognize today that to sort of read some of these things, for example, Lot and his daughters, and say, gee, in my modern-day American mindset, this is one of the most horrible things. How could this be? And just simply acknowledging this was a very, very different place and time, very different folks, where unto their social mores, what seems horrible to us was just a natural day of course for them.
Well, in this particular case, I think, while there have been, as I suggested, efforts to say that this is a hospitality gesture on Lot's part that is to be commended, I think that the text itself doesn't want to commend it. I think there's evidence within the text that wants to condemn Lot's behavior. But there is you raise a more general question here with regard to how ought our modern behaviors, contemporary behaviors, particularly as believers, to be shaped by the believers' behaviors that we see in these various texts. And welcome to a forever conversation. We're going to be on continuing to discern just exactly how it is that the ethical shape of the life in one context or another in the Old Testament, how that is to be, how transferable is it into a modern Christian world. So if you take the laws, I mean, all what, 600 plus laws that you've got, Jesus sums them up, you shall love Lord your God, you shall love the neighbor as yourself. We like to sort of take those two and go with them and forget the rest, but others want to take most of the rest. I don't know if anybody wants to take all of them. It's just, I want to say, this maybe isn't quite on target here, but I want to say that every law, or nearly everyone, has continuing import for Christian life. And the reason for that is, and it's is one must make a distinction between the law as a law and the concern that undergirds the law. Okay? And it may well be that the law as a law have importance as we reflect upon what to do and what not to do. So one of the awful things about the lectionary system is that in all the law material that we've got in Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, the lectionary has only three texts. The love of the Lord your God, you shall love the neighbor as yourself, and the Ten Commandments. They ignore the rest of the biblical material in these law texts. And one of the striking dimensions of these law texts again and again has to do with issues of social justice. And that theme, it pervades the law here. Okay, we may not be able to, the concern that undergirds the law here again and again is an issue of social justice. And so you take a text like Deuteronomy 15, if there is among you anyone in need, a member of your community in any of your towns within the land that the Lord your God has given you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward your needy neighbor. Why don't we get that one read to us regularly in church? I mean, here, you know, again, we have to look. It's complex. But I want to say there's a lot of continuity at some level between the ethical concerns that are lifted up in these texts and I think how we converse about behaviors. Yes, please.
You mentioned earlier there's no Hebrew word for punishment. Could you comment a little further on that and what the implications of some of the words that are translated is that like?
Yeah, we take a look at the Sodom and Gomorrah story. Mm-hmm. It's very striking what the NRSV does here. Genesis 19. And verse 15, when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, get up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or else you will be consumed in the punishment of the city. That word for punishment in Hebrew is avon, which is the everyday Hebrew word for iniquity. And so the question becomes, how do they get the punishment? And if you were to track these kinds of texts, a much better translation there would be calamity, disaster, or what I would say, the consequences of one's sin. Okay, if common avon is one iniquity, another is evil, ra'ah. Evil or wickedness. If we were to track this particular Hebrew word in, say, a book like Jeremiah, it's used over 300 times in the Old Testament, and you would see that ra'ah at times refers to the sin or the wickedness. And at other times, this very same word is used for the consequence. And so so that the judgment, and this is true now of Sodom and Gomorrah, the judgment is not something that is a sort of forensic act on God's part, where God now sees the sin of the people and places a penalty on the situation for what they have done. Rather, ra'ah leads to ra'ah. Avon leads to avon. The sin has effects, consequences, which ripple out from the commitment and have certain effects. And both the sin and the effects, the same language is used for both words, for both contexts. So that the consequence has an intrinsic relationship to the deed and not an extrinsic one. It grows out of the deed itself rather than being placed by God on the situation. And so then it becomes a question of how is God involved? You want to move to deism here, where God then is simply removed from the consequence. That becomes a big discussion. How does God mediate the consequences? How does God mediate the consequences? And sometimes some texts are a little bit more direct than that. Some are indirect. Sometimes God sort of delivers the mail. wife, there are going to be consequences. The baby's going to be born here, born to God. God functions then to see that sins have consequences. What, for what purpose? So that sin and evil do not go unchecked in the life of the world. So, yeah.
Can you connect that up in verse 13? Is the angels say we're going to destroy this place? So you have to flee.
Yeah.
So it's more. They're being proactive about something.
Yes, indeed. If you have, in terms of Sodom, you chapter 19 is sort of an illustration of how bad things have gotten in Sodom. Okay? And so you come to that determination. God goes down to see, and they go to the city and take a look at the situation and experience the evil of the city, and then this cannot be tolerated. And so the language that's used, God is involved here to some degree in a little bit more active mediation in this text than in many other texts. But God has not removed the divine self from the move from sin to consequence here. But it's a rippling effect of sin that God sees to the effects, and at varying levels of import, I suppose, or effect. I wonder if we don't need to. Well, we got 2 minutes here.
Another quick one. Is the salvific benefit of the death and resurrection of Christ a consequence or a forensic?
You mean salvific?
Well, the salvation in the death and resurrection of Christ, is it a consequence of what he did, or is it a forensic act of God?
How would that pertain to the situation? I think it's forensic in that particular situation, but I'm not certain the connection here with what we're talking about.
Well, you were different to me. What Jesus did is the way for us to salvation. Mm-hmm. And when we say Jesus died for me and God forgives me, period, in a forensic act, mm-hmm. it takes away the consequential process.
Well, it does and it doesn't. You're not removed. None of us in this room are removed from the consequences of the sins that we commit. We suffer the consequences of our own sin and the consequences of other people's sin all the time, even though we are forgiven. Forgiveness does not entail deliverance from consequences. I mean, we can forgive somebody who's killed somebody else, but we're going to still send them to prison.
Is dying with Christ a consequence?
And where are you going with that?
To me, Jesus says, come die with me. And we've changed it to Jesus died for me. Therefore, if I trust that or believe that, there's a forensic act, and I'm forgiven and saved, and it's all taken care of.
Well, it's all taken care of.
To me, it's a dying with Christ problem.
Yeah. Well, I think we maybe have to have this conversation at another level. I'm not certain about it.